Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. President Trump has called this Made in America Week, so this hour we ask our two guests, what is Made in America now? Do trade agreements hurt American manufacturing? How many robots are taking human jobs? In Wisconsin, where the economy relies on manufacturing, since 2000, we have lost 90,000 of our manufacturing jobs. We'll ask why and what replaces those jobs. And then, to put this in news of the last day, there was news yesterday that Harley-Davidson is eliminating 180 production jobs at U.S. plants. But there was news in May that a motorcycle assembly plant, is going to open in 2018. They'll be assembling bikes produced at U.S. facilities, and the plant is opening in Thailand. Are those two stories related in some way? We have two guests with us, and we'll have many phone calls, I'm sure, on this important issue. Diana Furchgott-Roth is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and director of the Institute's Economics 21 program. She served on President Trump's transition team, and she has also served in the George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Reagan administrations, and is the author of several books on economics, politics, and feminism. Diana, hello. Thanks for being with us. It's been a while since we last spoke.
Be with you.
Nice to have you here.
To be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Professor Michael Hicks is also joining us. He is Distinguished Professor of Economics and the Director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. His research focusing on in-state and local public finance and the effect of policy on economic activity. He's the author of three books, including The Local Economic Impact of Walmart. Professor Hicks, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, I'm delighted to be with you.
Yeah. Well, let's start with this because this is Made in America Week. What is Made in America that's doing very well, thank you? Diana?
Well, there are a lot of things that we export. We export a large number of capital goods, industrial equipment and supplies. We also export services, so there are many, many things where we have a comparative advantage. Transportation equipment, computer and electronics products. Think of all those iPhones that people want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Chemicals, plus miscellaneous manufactured commodities, agricultural products, petroleum and coal products. We're getting to be a large oil and gas exporter, and that's going to continue.
Professor Hicks, you want to add to that?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. We also are huge exporters of agricultural commodities, in particular here in the Midwest, all types of services, educational services. And I think increasingly American exports, one way to frame this would be we are attracting foreign direct investment in the United States. Subaru, Honda, Toyota plants that we have here in Indiana and elsewhere that are making things that our foreign companies prefer to be accessing American markets, and including for labor and raw materials.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about manufacturing jobs for a moment. I started the hour by talking about the huge number of manufacturing jobs that we have lost in the state of Wisconsin, and we are a heavy manufacturing production place. What has happened to the 90,000-some workers who have lost their jobs since the year 2000? Have they been able to find jobs that are good, or have we just sort of lost our manufacturing export place in the world's economy?
Well, you know, let me take a shot at it.
Sure.
I live here in Indiana, where we have we've lost more like 250,000 workers over the same time period, both in Wisconsin, Indiana, at all-time record employment peak right now. So it's hard to know what happened to those workers individually. Many of them have retired. The average manufacturing worker in 2000 was in his or her early to mid-50s, and so many of them are no longer in the labor market. But the United States manufacturing industry is fairly strong. We're at 2015 was the record production year of manufacturing production in inflation-adjusted dollars in American history. Of course, manufacturing employment peaked in 1979. We were down a little bit in 2016, but 2017 looks fairly good. So we have certainly not as strong a manufacturing as we'd like. We'd like to see 4% growth in manufacturing and employment overall, but It is not a crisis in the sense that production is in trouble. The real challenge is that employment growth has not matched production growth over the past 3 or 4 decades.
Mm-hmm. And you, Diana, have written about the number of jobs that are needed, that there are 6 million openings for workers in this country, but for some reason we're not getting the people in those jobs. What's the disconnect?
Well, sometimes they're not qualified for the jobs that are open, and sometimes they feel with the money that they could get not working, such as Medicaid and food stamps and health insurance subsidies, it's not worth going into the labor market. Sometimes they don't have the right education for that particular job opening. But to follow Michael's comments about manufacturing, just because employment in manufacturing has declined does not mean that the sector is not doing well. When you think about it, at the end of the 1700s, most Americans were employed in agriculture. That has, of course, gone down to about 2%, but now we make enough food to feed the whole world. So because our manufacturing is getting more capital intensive and we're increasing our productivity in that sector, it's doing very, very well, and we can't just judge a sector by the number of people employed in it. Otherwise, you could say that one group of people digging ditches and another people filling them in would be a good thing, but we know that that's not.
Mm-hmm. How many of those jobs, then, are being done by robots, Professor?
Hard to say for sure, in part because the technological change that we talk about really isn't just robotics. And for example, the 1990s, most of the productivity growth in the United States was process-oriented. We had just-in-time inventory systems, statistical process control that brought, you know, assembly part equipment right to the shop floor. And we had radio frequency identification that allowed us to track products from train or ship all the way to the store shelves. And the improvements in supply chains fueled productivity. That eliminated, you know, the old shop warehouse folks and the people who would move those things maybe manually, but they weren't really robotics. So robotics is we've had robotics around for 40, 50 years doing things. The difference today is that the scale and the cost of robotics is much lower because of artificial intelligence or machine learning means that you don't have to write 1,800 lines of computer code to have a particular process implemented. You can teach a machine through some human interaction how to do something and then walk away from it. And with the use of sensors, it can probably do a lot of tasks, from screwing on bolts on wheels to doing security sweeps of areas a lot more efficiently than humans might have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the number of jobs, the number of companies, because we've heard this has been happening, and now we have a case to point to here in Wisconsin. Harley Davidson, very well known really throughout the world, announced this week they're eliminating 180 production jobs at U.S. plants. They said late in May that they are going to be opening a motorcycle assembly plant in Thailand. Is there a connection between those two, and how many companies have opened plants in other countries because of labor costs? How significant is that? Diana?
Well, labor costs are lower in other countries, so in some areas there is a temptation to open plants there, especially when these companies are exporting to those areas. So say that there's an agricultural equipment company that's exporting to the Far East. It might make sense to have a plant there and employ local people and manufacture those goods there. The question is how many companies are setting up plants offshore and then importing the goods back to the United States. That certainly is happening also, and we need to make sure that we keep regulations down and we don't raise the minimum wage too much and we don't discourage employers from hiring here in the United States.
Do you agree with that, Professor?
Yeah, the bulk of it, but I think there's a couple of points that are worth meriting. I particularly like Diana's first, you know, point that it's very common for businesses who are, you know, selling motorcycles, for example, throughout South East Asia to build a plant there. But there's a temptation to believe that because foreign workers take less salary or have lower labor, what you think are labor costs or health insurance costs, that they're cheaper. And that's not always true. The real issue is the cost of that worker relative to the output that they produce or the value of the goods they manufacture. And so if you just were going on the labor cost, the hourly wages, all the goods in the world would be made in Sri Lanka or Botswana, right? And that's clearly not the case. I mean, so what really matters to manufacturers is the cost per unit produced. And there are many industries that the United States does very well in. Diana just listed a number of these, from, you know, soybeans and corn through computer products, artificial joints, advanced manufacturing of transportation equipment and avionics. Those are things that you would want to make in America, and if they're close to markets, all the better. So the Honda factory, the Toyota factory, and the Subaru factories in Indiana are all transplants that are extraordinarily productive plants, even though those workers there are making American manufacturing wages and receiving American health care benefits. So it's not simply a matter of the wage that a foreign worker will make, but how good are those workers at doing their job. And high-skilled work is going to be a comparative advantage of the United States for some time.
And another comparative advantage that we have is our protection of intellectual property. Some companies prefer to produce here in the United States because they know that their designs will not get copied and stolen and then sold at more cut-rate prices with lower quality by foreign firms. And having the rule of law here in the United States is a tremendous advantage to many companies that are producing new technology. And another reason is that we have low energy prices. There are companies coming from Germany, such as Siemens, for example, which are attracted by our low energy costs. Many companies are actually relocating back to the United States after having tried to produce overseas.
Hmm. Diana, you served on the president's transition team. When he calls President Trump this week Made in America Week, what does he mean by that? What does he want to have happen?
The president is trying to highlight those products that are made in America in order to show that we still make many, many good products here in the United States. And he's trying to use his pulpit as president to unconsciously or consciously persuade firms to stay here in the United States rather than manufacturing offshore.
And when he talks about persuading firms to stay here, he has been talking about tariffs. There was the possibility of a tariff to be announced sometime this week on steel imports to the United States. Is that a good idea? Is that a good idea in terms of seeing steel manufacturing really flourish more in this country? And should tariffs be extended to other things we make here?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. It's a great question, because when I served as chief of staff of President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers in 2001, there was the same debate, should we put tariffs on steel? And the Council of Economic Advisers argued no. Other places within the administration argued yes. We lost out, and the tariffs were imposed. But then they were rolled back later because that causes the price of steel to go up. And our manufacturers, those who use the steel, were not happy with it. So these decisions are always made with many, many people chiming in and advising the president, and then he makes the final decision.
You want to respond to that, Professor Hicks, tariff question?
Yeah, right. So two things in general. I'm sure Diana would agree that in general tariffs are bad. Free trade is an outstanding way to reduce poverty, to improve the standard of living, to allow countries and individual regions and households to, you know, focus on their comparative advantage. And there's a long history of that. In particular, though, there are worries about companies not playing by the same set of rules. And I don't mean, you know, sort of cost rules. Regions may decide they want to impose higher environmental labor standards, but the rule of law particularly is problematic. You know, there are a number of firms in the United States. I won't name it on the air, but I have a good friend who owns a factory here and a factory in China, and he will make the wire in China, but he will not assemble it into the apparatus that he uses. He will re-import the wire to the United States and have it assembled here, not because you know, he is friendly to any region, but because he doesn't trust the Chinese not to steal his patentable ideas. And those are things that trade arrangements should target, is the, you know, extending the rule of law, and particularly property rights, and you know, also, in particularly in the case of steel, companies may receive financial benefits by host countries because they believe that, you know, the company is particularly important, or they have a friend in the Politburo. And those are things that renegotiation of trade agreements could work. But they're not, you know, the goal is to make more trade occur, not less. And I think that's, you know, one thing that I think most Americans would agree could be a target of renegotiating trade deals are those. And we, it's important to say, United States is not completely perfect in these things. We have support for domestic industries that maybe could make other countries come at us with the same critique, but generally we're a relatively free, tariff-free country, and most of our trading partners are less so.
Diana, do you think trade agreements have on the whole hurt American manufacturing?
Well, it's hard to say one can't look at manufacturing as a whole. Trade agreements have certainly helped many, many people, especially consumers whose paychecks are made larger by buying goods that are at a lower price. And it's helped some companies. It's hurt some companies also. But the idea of these trade agreements is that the most efficient companies can sell goods to more places, and that the whole group of countries becomes more efficient, people's incomes are higher, and prices are lower. This is called the theory of comparative advantage. So that has certainly happened with different trade agreements that we have.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. This is The President Has Deemed It So, Made in America Week. He drew focus to many things that are made in America and urged us to buy American-made goods. America First is a big theme of this presidency. So what do you make of this? Do you think that America is flourishing when it comes to the goods that are made here? It seems as though a lot of goods are made from all parts of the world and then assembled in one part of the world or another. Do you worry about jobs being lost? We keep hearing that a lot of robots can do the work that human people used to do. What about the large number of manufacturing jobs? We've lost many of them here in the state of Wisconsin. Our guest, one of them, is from Indiana, where they've lost perhaps even more. So what has happened to all of those jobs? Are there manufacturing jobs that simply have gone out of existence? Why is it that some companies have moved plants overseas? Does it make sense to try to lure them back in some way? And would that create more jobs? Are wages too high? Are minimum wage hikes, which we're going to be talking about tomorrow, something that's hurting industry? But then again, people have to live. You can't live on salaries that aren't high enough to allow you to have a roof over your head and food on the table. So what do we do about income? What happened to all the people who used to have manufacturing jobs? Is there a huge disconnect between what industries need and the skill of the workforce in America? Do we need to make sure that there are more people? Those who are not in the workforce need to be on a path that will get them a job that is in existence. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we always like to read your comments, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Diana Furtgott-Roth, who's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Michael Hicks, George and Francis Ball, distinguished professor of economics at Ball State University. And we start our calls with Ray in Stevens Point. Hi, Ray.
Hi. When your guest was discussing discussing Harley-Davidson moving to Thailand, she cited Thailand's low wages, but she neglected to mention their high tariffs. When Harley announced that move, they said that the major reason was to avoid Thailand's high tariffs of over 100% of the value of a motorcycle. This idea of free trade is great in the economics algorithm, but it does not exist in the real world, and America's workers have been sacrificed to this mythical ideology of free trade, which doesn't exist.
Thanks for the call, Ray. Diana?
Well, the caller is right that we do need to enforce the free trade laws, and one example is the Section 301 reports that the U.S. Trade Representative puts out every April about how different countries are violating our intellectual property laws. These countries range from China to Vietnam to other countries, and our government needs to take strong steps against these violations. But if there is a country that does have a tariff, and that tariff is there legally, then I believe it's not illegal for a company to put a manufacturing plant in there to avoid that tariff.
Thanks for the call. We go to David next in Green Bay. Hi, David.
Hi. I want to say thanks for having these guests on. I've really enjoyed it so far. I'm just wondering what the Trump administration could do to acknowledge the economic opportunity posed by renewable energy. I read something over the past few months that China's really been putting their efforts into making solar and putting it ahead of some of their fossil fuels. And I'm wondering if taking a different stance on the coal versus renewable energy debate would help manufacturing jobs here. And I don't know the lingo, but I'll hang up and then listen to your answer on the radio.
That's fine. Thanks for the call. Professor Hicks, you want to start?
Yeah, right. So we've seen growth in renewable energies really from fractionally unimportant to modestly unimportant in the United States over the past decade and a half. But what has really fueled the change in cost and geographic distribution of fuel usage has been fracking, of course, and the Bakken oil fields. So in particular, the shift away from coal to natural gas is what has driven sort of the, what Diana mentioned earlier, the export ability of American energy and the reduced carbon consumption. Now, we've just gone through a decade or so of extraordinary incentivization to alternative fuels, and it's again gone from, well under a quarter of a percent to, a percent of energy usage. There are very real physics problems related to extending, base load fuels on wind and solar, which is what we're talking about. Peaking energy, maybe, but base sources, we're in a world of using fossil fuels for the lengthy and foreseeable future.
Thanks very much for your call. We go to Dory in Madison. Hi, Dory.
Hi. I don't know what to believe that I read on the internet, so I was wondering if either of your guests would know if most or all of the Trump family products are produced overseas, and I can also take my call off the air.
All right, Dory. Diana.
Well, it's certainly true that some of Ivanka Trump's clothes are produced overseas, and we've seen labels that show that. Many, many clothes that are sold in the United States are produced overseas because that makes them more affordable. But there are other Trump products that are here in the United States, such as some of the golf clubs and hotels. And people come all over the world to go to America's hotels, not, of course, just the Trump hotels, but we are a source of tourism. People come also for education. So there is a mixture of the two.
Have we pretty much given up? It is true, if you go to a store, almost everything you look at is made in either China or Vietnam or Thailand or sometimes Mexico or Nicaragua. Do we make clothes at all in this country anymore, Professor Hicks?
Very little. We still make a few specialized fabrics. You can get bespoke handmade shoes in New York. Last factory that made jeans, I think, is in Los Angeles. They whip off $140, $150 a pair. I don't own any of them. I doubt I fit into any of them. So you know, we do not have a comparative advantage in making clothes. We Americans own a lot of clothes. We like to buy clothes. And we do not have a comparative advantage because they're not particularly skilled industries. We spend, you know, $125,000 on a kid to get he or she out of high school, that much again to get them a college degree in the public sphere oftentimes. We are just not going to be good at doing stuff that somebody with a fifth, sixth, eighth grade education can do that's highly routinized, and we shouldn't aspire to you know, bring back jobs like that into the United States. So, you know, as far as the Trump family, I don't know. My guess is that the distribution of Made in America stuff for the Trump family is just like it is for everything else. If it's something that's, you know, really low-skilled work with low transportation costs, they make overseas. If it's concrete, it's made in the United States. You know, Donald Trump's probably best known production is in intellectual property in a TV show. That's all made in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also, according to reports that I've read, used steel from China for the Trump Tower, right?
Well, I don't know how you would not if you lived on the coast. If you're in the middle part of the country, you're probably going to use Gary steel, which is not produced by an American company. It's produced by the largest steel manufacturer in the country, which is ArcelorMittal, an Indian company.
Really?
Yeah, in Gary, Indiana.
Isn't that something? The world really is. It's hard to find anything made in any one place, isn't it? They're made a little bit here, a little bit there. Cars particularly, they're all over the world, all the parts for them, aren't they?
And we should be so thankful for that, because what that means is that the things that are made in each place are those things that that region has some comparative advantage, that they can do better. So the electronics in the car, the software is being written in Silicon Valley, the glass components in upstate New York, the very inexpensive electronics inside of it may be put together in Taiwan. The rubber is being manufactured or raw material in Liberia, being processed with steel wire in New York from steel that's imported from China to a U.S. port. All those things make cars cheaper.
Right.
They make our lives safer. They make our lives better. They let us divert more income to other things. And that's the big story that people miss is if you go back to when my dad was a boy 80 years ago, two-thirds almost of all American consumption was in goods, physical items to populate their home, to clothe their back, and to feed them and to get transportation. In the 1960s, that dropped to 50%. Now it's about a third of what we buy are food, clothing, housing, and transportation, and the rest of the money we spend are on services, on listening to the public radio, on going to the doctor, on watching movies, and buying education. And that's really what makes us the impression that we're not making stuff in America. Our GDP is at a record now. We're making more stuff and more stuff per person than we ever have before.
Mm. Thanks, Dory, very much for your call. Robert, driving through Wisconsin. Hi.
You know, I two points here. If I can replace somebody with a $25,000 machine, I'm not going to pay them $15 an hour. And this is a misnomer saying you're going to pay somebody $15 an hour, because that's not what it costs. By the time you add Social Security, your insurance payments, your workman's comp payments, your unemployment payments, your COBRA payments, your disability, your Medicare, your Medicaid payments, you're probably looking at $20 or $25 an hour. $25 an hour times a 2,000-hour work year is 50 grand a year. Do you really think somebody flipping burgers should make 50 grand a year?
Yeah, we're not really talking a whole lot about it. It's a focus of our show tomorrow, but let's talk about wages for a moment, Diana. Are workers making too much money?
Well, I don't think anyone would think that they personally were making too much money. You can probably stop anyone on the street and ask if they were underpaid or overpaid. They would all say that they were underpaid and deserve a raise. But I think that one cannot just make generalizations over particular workers, over a whole group. People are, in general, paid what their employers think they are worth. They are free to change jobs and move to a higher-paying job or a lower-paying job with more flexible hours. And there's an entire compensation package that's made up of, say, dirty, dangerous jobs such as logging and mining, where you have to pay more, to easier jobs such as mine, sitting in an office where you don't have to be paid for that dangerous, dirty stuff. So there's a very wide range of jobs, a very wide range of salaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, I still want to go back to those 90,000 people who lost their jobs here in Wisconsin, because that's where we are in the moment from manufacturing. They were in manufacturing. The plants have closed. You can see it all over the city of Milwaukee, what used to be family-supporting good jobs, union jobs, paying good wages. Is there a real disconnect now between, I don't know, what jobs are available and what people are trained for right now? Because we keep hearing about how the middle class, well, look at what happened in the election, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders doing so well. And they were talking to people who just haven't been able to make ends meet, who aren't getting wages increases in their pay, who are having a really hard time. What's the disconnect here? And would we have better manufacturing rates and a stronger America, more things made in America, if people were able to have a better life? Professor?
Yeah, you know, that's a lengthy question. I think it's, when we think about manufacturing, there's this supposition that that's somehow more meritorious than other economic activity. New York City has almost no manufacturing. It's the most affluent city in the country. If you go to, you know, Fairfax County, Virginia, or Orange County, California, no manufacturing there, very affluent places. Manufacturing's good. I like it. I study it a lot, but it's not more meritorious than other economic activity that provides value to consumers. In terms of the way automation and trade have played out, you know, I think the reason I'm on is that I've authored studies on trade, manufacturing, and automation, and it looks like automation is causing the bulk, I don't think there's much ambiguity amongst economists, the bulk of job loss and displacement. You can't replace somebody with a $25,000 machine. It's more like a quarter of a million, but that's enough in many places to do so. And I think the worry that my authors had in our most recent study on the vulnerability communities, it's not that we're going to lose jobs. We've been through that. We're going to go through that. But maybe we're in the midst of a more accelerated period of job losses due to automation. I'm not positive about that, but it certainly seems it could be the case. And as jobs are created, because we're at record employment in almost every American state in the U.S. as a whole, they're not created in the same places nor with the same skills. And so that could potentially leave both vast swaths of economy. I'm talking about, you know, 9-10 county regions bigger than Vermont, for example, behind. They're continuing to lose population very rapidly, and households are most heavily affected. Automation tends to affect lower income workers and workers with less education, and so I think automation may be what's fueling the economic inequality, because the irony of automation is if machines don't replace your job, they probably complement it, make you more productive. And so we're seeing this polarization into sort of low-skilled, low-wage workers and high-skilled, high-wage workers because of automation. And that, I think, is fueling the fact that we're on the radio talking about what would otherwise be a fairly esoteric subject today.
So what are we going to do about that? The inequality, the increased automation. Professor?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think what Diane was saying is there are, in many places, there are a huge amount of job shortages. In urban places, for example, unemployment rate probably hovers at 2% in a number of areas. And so you hear businesses scrambling and advertising, and you see fantastic, you know, wage rates for skilled workers in urban places. And then you get to a rural place that's seen population decline or a plant closing or that has less educational attainment, and there's an excess supply of workers. And so, you know, we have to examine what public policy is doing to keep people trapped in places that that are not going to be productive. Are we being honest about them, that the communities they live in are not going to see the same sort of economic growth that they have in decades or centuries past? And I'm confident that in the long run, automation and trade will make us all better off. I don't think you could find a living, breathing economist that would say otherwise. I also think in the short run, we could see a lot more political discontent and frustration with the political economy, the way jobs are distributed and employment and wages grow as a consequence of these factors. And it's important to understand what they are so you don't treat the wrong symptom.
Diane, I'd like your thoughts on this, too. What do we do about all those people who are in areas that aren't doing very well? Do they have to move?
There are a lot of job openings in industries such as financial services, computer coding, things like occupational therapy, that whole range of health services. Education and health services grew every single month, even during the Great Recession. And it's a matter of steering people into community colleges where they can get associate degrees in these kinds of subjects and get retrained. But yes, if a plant does close down in one particular area, one would hope that there would be perhaps tax credits that would encourage other enterprises to move in, or otherwise there would have to be some movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, forgive me, but I've been doing talk shows for a heck of a long time, and I can remember doing this very subject years and years and years ago. We don't seem to have this quite fixed yet. We've talked about not having people for certain kinds of jobs, not having a pipeline for years, Professor Hicks.
You're right. I actually did a study on the teacher shortage phenomenon that was up a couple of years ago, and you can find, you know, just breathless news articles from 1900 about worker shortages. Markets are imperfect in the sense that we don't always have the right number of people in the right place with the right skills. And there are businesses that maybe have business models that don't work. They're going to have to pay workers more, and they're going to then be uncompetitive. Part of that's normal. That's an economy that's dynamic and improving and changing. And that necessarily means that people lose jobs and bad businesses go away and new ones reappear. That's healthy and good. The challenge would be, are we going to go through a period where, you know, instead of having a job turnover in the single digits and, you know, loss of, you know, a few occupations each year, are we going to go through a period where, you know, more rapid automation eliminates a quarter of jobs in a generation and then only replaces them maybe by the same number of job openings in other places with vastly different skills? Mm-hmm. Diane is right about the policy prescription to some degree about filling the gaps where there are good paying jobs available. The problem is community colleges graduate about 1 in 4 young men and women who show up. And so the problems in those schools and in those educational systems probably began decades earlier for the men and women who are failing out of junior college or technical college. So it's not, you know, it's not as easy as a job training program. The problem may have been in an insufficiency of middle school math a decade and a half earlier. And so I think these are complex problems, and we have, as Diana mentioned earlier, structured a sort of compensation system for unemployed workers that does a lot to incentivize them not to move, not to seek retraining, not to look for a job, not to pack up and move west. And that sort of dynamism is, I think, really ultimately very important for an economy, and having lost mm-hmm. that or set it aside temporarily is a problem for us.
Well, let me ask both of you this. Don't you really think, though, that most people want to work? I mean, if you're just getting benefits, you're having a hard life. You don't make that much with food stamps and unemployment benefits, which you don't get for that long. Wouldn't most people, and I think they would, want a job? Don't they, Diana?
Many people do want a job, and the higher the what's called replacement rate, the higher the combination of different services you give somebody, in terms of food stamps and Medicaid and unemployment insurance, the more tempted they are just to stay on these benefits. So an unemployed person gets 26 weeks of unemployment insurance, and we can see from the data that many of them find a new job right before that unemployment insurance expires at the end of that period. The more that we offer people in terms of aid, the less likely they are to be forced to actually get another job. So yes, people do want another job, but sometimes the job that they want isn't available, and then they just wait and hang on and see if they can find that ideal job, whereas really they should just take a job that maybe not a 10 on their preference scale, maybe it's a 5 or a 6, get started with that, and then move to another one later on when they find it. There's a tremendous amount of turnover in the U.S. labor force. We have about 50 million new hires a year and about 48 million separations in a labor force of over 150 million. It's a constant churn. We need to make sure people get in the labor force as fast as possible, because the longer they are out, the more they lose skills, the more they lose networks, and the more they get into bad habits.
Let's go to Anne in Monona. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Well, I find this incredibly offensive. I wonder whether your two guests, who are very much white-collar workers, would apply the same standards to themselves as they seem to apply to people who do, you know, work like, I don't know, electricians work and plumbing and you know, any kind of work that actually requires a lot of skill. You've presented most workers as being very low-skilled, you know, like people who make clothes are low-skilled workers. Many of those people have made their own clothes at home and were very high-skilled. They belong to unions. The aim of globalization has been to destroy unions, destroy labor, basically destroy salaries, and funnel all that money to the top. And I don't see that these high-flying pronouncements from people like your two guests are very valuable. And suppose you were forced to work for, say, suppose the workers decided you were worth about $10 an hour each. Would you work doing what you're doing now, and you'd lose your offices, you'd lose your perks, you couldn't make these pronouncements, or if you did, no one would listen to you? I really find this, you know, This is part of the problem. We have people who are spouting these misleading statements.
Professor Hicks.
So I'm a retired infantry officer, so I don't know that many people would characterize me as a lifetime member of the white-collar class. Look, globalization affects us all, right? So I always laugh at somebody working in Wisconsin as a plumber faces zero globalization pressure, making a lot more money than an English professor or an anthropology professor. Have you looked at the composition of a university today? If you want to see foreign pressure, you know, more than half of American PhDs are not American. So the notion that this, you know, globalization pressure comes from, A, that it's bad is sort of silly, but B, that it comes from only in factory work is sort of silly. Services are an area where the United States does a lot of exporting, and where international competition, if I publish a paper or I speak to a radio show, Diana doesn't sound to me like she was born in Ohio. So that is really sort of a red herring here. The fact is that we should be losing workers in the United States who are low-skilled and low productivity, either for their own fault or their organization of the business that they're in, and they should be moving to places where they acquire more skills, can make more money. We have a fancy name for that in economics. It's called growth.
Diana, you want to respond to the comments?
I'd like to say that there are many, many jobs that are vacant that are relatively high-skilled and high-paying, such as the electricians that your caller mentioned. We also have trouble finding welders and plumbers. The earnings for these particular skills are going up as fewer people are going into them. To qualify, you don't have to have a four-year BA. You can get an associate degree. So there is a wide range of jobs available, and I don't think either Michael or myself looking down on any of these occupations. And many of these low-skilled jobs are ideal for someone who wants to get into the workforce, and many people find that they quickly move to higher levels, such as a fast food worker who would then become a manager of a McDonald's, for example.
Well, it's also true, though, isn't it, that some of those jobs, when you mentioned healthcare workers, we look at education salaries, which at least in this state have fallen quite a bit. Healthcare workers, people who do valuable, important work of taking care of vulnerable people who are taking care of infants and children and daycare workers, they may be growing fields, but they pay really poorly, don't they, Diana?
Some of those are low-paying jobs, but the wages for nurses, for example, have gone up very, very substantially over the past 20 years. This is now a very well-paying profession. Occupational therapists, physical therapists, radiology technicians, these are jobs where you can get a two-year associate degree from a community college, and you can be earning about $45,000 when you graduate with hardly any debt, because community college on average costs $2,000 to $3,000 a year. And high school guidance counselors should be encouraging more students to take this route rather than getting the four-year BA in a liberal arts or humanities subject.
Mm. And what about those other workers? What about the people who are doing home assistance, who are assisting people who are disabled, who are assisting the elderly, who are working in daycare centers and early childhood education? Those are all important jobs. Should our economy be rewarding that kind of work in a service sector economy, which is growing, Professor Hicks?
No, and it does. I mean, so wages, particularly in healthcare, are rising across the board. Diana just laid out, two things about healthcare that changed radically from a half century ago is the growth in specialized occupations that are entry level, middle class to upper middle class jobs. They also offer pathways beyond that. I mean, almost there's no hospital in America today that's not providing educational supplement to good workers who can then go from being an x-ray tech to more advanced skill training. So those are huge service sectors, are huge places for growth in government employment, which, I'll use teachers, for example. Teachers are generally thought not to be paid well. The question is, are we attracting workers into those areas? And the way you tell in markets if there is a problem or a disconnect is not your judgment on if these are overpaid or underpaid, but really you can compare them to other levels of education and skills and time and exposure of risk to the job, but it is really whether or not people show up for those jobs. And so in areas where you don't have enough workers, I actually think that the bigger problem is in the, it's not those middle-skilled, white-collar jobs, school teachers and other public employees, but it's rather in areas that are skill trade that I think are going to be places of big wage growth, because we don't have workers moving into being plumbers and electricians and likewise, which even right now offer mid-career salaries that are a lot better than, assistant professor or associate professor of anthropology or English.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network. Let's go to David in Ironwood, Michigan next. Hi, David.
Yeah, I have a few questions if you let me do them.
I can't do a few. We got a minute and a half left.
If I build a robot to replace myself, what I'm going to do? Should all that money go to the super rich and I'm left to just starve? I mean, someone said that in the next 20 years, 80% of the jobs can be automated. And then the other point is, I live in Ironwood. If I go to Silicon Valley, I can't sell my home and move there. Government should maybe help that out, get affordable housing in places where there are good jobs.
All right. Thank you. Diana.
Well, maybe what you could do is you could run the robot. You would get paid for running the robot that did your job, and you would have more leisure time. Your productivity would be higher, and you could have more time for yourself. And in fact, the work week for men has been shrinking ever since the 1940s, gradually going down. As people have become more productive, people have more leisure time, and This is not necessarily a bad thing. And no, we do not want robots to be pushing people out of jobs. On the other hand, we are going to need people to operate these robots. We have so many more professions that weren't even thought of when I was in college, such as developing apps, doing shared economy platforms on different kinds of services. The sky is the limit, but people have to be willing to have enough basic education that they can change fields in the middle of their careers.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to both of you. Diana Furtgott-Roth, thank you. Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, thanks to you. Professor Michael Hicks, thank you very much. Distinguished Professor at the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. We want to thank Gretchen Brown and Colleen Leahy for production of this show and also for on-air production of the program. Thanks for all of your phone calls. And we will continue with another hour. We're going to learn a whole lot about somebody we unfortunately have overlooked, Ulysses S. Grant.